This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Melton. A federal judge has refused to delay sentencing for Roger Stone on his conviction for witness tampering and lying to Congress. AP correspondent Shelley Adler has more.
The decision by Judge Amy Berman Jackson came after President Trump tweeted that Stone's conviction, quote, should be thrown out. Stone's defense team has requested a new trial, but with Stone present on speakerphone from his lawyer's office, Jackson ruled that delaying the sentence, quote, would not be a prudent thing to do. The judge did indicate she would delay the execution of the sentence pending resolution of the motion for a new trial. Stone is scheduled to be sentenced Thursday. Shelley Adler, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump told reporters Tuesday he's pardoned several notable people, including a former New York police commissioner and a former Wall Street investor.
We have Bernie Carrick. We have Mike Milken, who's gone around and done an incredible job for the world with all of his research on cancer.
Carrick is the police commissioner, and the president was referring with Mike Milken to investor Mike Milken, who served 22 months in prison in the 1980s for securities fraud, had began funding medical research after his release. The president granted him a full pardon. The Boy Scouts of America have filed for bankruptcy in a U.S. federal court in a move the group says will allow it to compensate men who were abused as boys while taking part in its programs. The organization has faced a surge in lawsuits in recent years as multiple states enacted changes to laws allowing those victimized as kids to bring legal action later in life. Several thousand men accused scoutmasters and other leaders of molestation, with many of their cases dating back to the 1960s, the 1970s, and the 1980s. You can find more on these and other stories online at voanews.com. This is VOA News. International parties are welcoming news that Yemen government, backed by a Saudi-led military coalition, and Iranian-allied Houthi rebels have reached a deal on a first large-scale prisoner exchange since the start of the five-year conflict in Yemen. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, Jordan.
The United Nations mission in Yemen announced that the warring sides agreed to immediately begin exchanging lists for the upcoming release of prisoners, calling it the first official large-scale exchange of its kind since the beginning of the long-running conflict in Yemen. But the tentative peace plan stumbled amid ongoing military offenses and a deep-seated distrust between the two sides. Still, Fareed Al-Hamed, spokesman for the International Committee of the Red Cross Yemen, called this deal a great step forward.
We are happy that though the conduct of hostilities is still ongoing in Yemen, but parties are trying to put more emphasis on the humanitarian needs through these releases.
Al-Hamed says the ICRC and the United Nations hope the warring sides will honor the commitment they just made. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
The number of casualties from Yemen's conflict are staggering. The United Nations has verified at least 7,500 civilians died. But other monitors, such as the U.S.-based Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, have registered more than 100,000 deaths, including those of 12,000 civilians killed in direct attacks. The U.N. Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said Tuesday civilians are at higher risk than ever in Syria, as forces backing the government carry out an offensive to take back territory in the northwestern part of the country. Speaking in Geneva, Bachelet called for all parties involved in the fighting to institute a ceasefire and to put in place humanitarian corridors to allow civilians safe passage. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad gave a rare television address Monday, pledging the key city of Aleppo will return stronger than ever after his forces took back control of the area from rebel fighters. On Tuesday, in an interview with the Associated Press, UN Chief Antonio Guterres called on the world community to help stop the suffering of the Syrian people.
So to see these Syrian people suffering so much is horrible. And so what we need to do is not to use it for any kind of political purpose, is to do everything we can to stop the suffering of the Syrian people.
The UN says 298 civilians have been killed since the beginning of the year in the provinces of Idlib and Aleppo. It blames 93% of those deaths on airstrikes by Syria and its Russian ally. And Afghanistan's Independent Election Commission says President Ashraf Ghani has won a second term as president. I'm Marissa Melton. You're listening to VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 19th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visits Africa to strengthen ties with the continent.
The Chinese, for the last at least 2 decades, have been much more strategic in their engagement with the continent. And you get the sense that America is essentially playing catch-up.
A second round of UN-sponsored talks on Libya has resumed in Geneva. Cameroon's military allegedly killed dozens of people in the northwest of the country last Friday. Survivors of Kenya's Nyaho House torture chambers demand compensation years after their detention. And Uganda releases additional 13 Rwandan citizens.
It must be understood that the withdrawal of the charges against these people is simply an option that the government of Uganda has chosen in order to facilitate normalization of relations in the context of the Rwanda process.
Sam Kutesa is Uganda's foreign minister, and Gambia's president calls for an end to tribal politics. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and the African Union chairman on Tuesday in Addis Ababa at the end of a whirlwind Africa tour that included Senegal and Angola. Pompeo's first official visit to Africa aims to strengthen commercial ties and revamp America's presence on the continent in countering China's growing dominance. But as Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa, political analysts say restoring U.S. influence in Africa will be a challenge.
A key question for the U.S. Secretary of State was how the U.S. can overcome Chinese dominance in Africa. China surpassed the U.S. as the continent's number one trading partner over a decade ago, and Beijing is investing heavily in African infrastructure. But convincing African leaders to look to the U.S. at this juncture is proving a challenge, say analysts. London University School of Oriental and African Studies Professor of International Relations, Stephen Chan, spoke via a messaging app.
I think that many African leaders are going to be quite skeptical, dealing increasingly now with very sophisticated people who basically want to know where the proof of the pudding is. And they've noticed Mr. Trump's volatility in the past, and they've particularly noticed comments that they would interpret as racist.
Trump reportedly used a vulgar term to describe African countries during a 2018 closed-door meeting. Just days ahead of Pompeo's arrival, Trump expanded a travel ban that restricts immigrant visas on citizens from Eritrea, Nigeria, Sudan, and Tanzania. The administration argues that countries have not met U.S. security requirements and information sharing, and that the ban would not affect tourists, businesses, or student visas. But the European Center for Development Policy Management's Alfonso Medinilla says that timing on the visa restrictions sends the wrong message. He spoke via a messaging app.
These are things that African countries are looking at quite closely. I mean, this idea of visa facilitation has always been very high on the agenda, and has very significant symbolic value. So going in the other direction is problematic. I mean, to me, what it shows is also, and this is not necessarily about Africa, it's more about American internal issues and internal struggles.
Muriti Mutiga is the Horn of Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group. He says Americans have an outdated view of Africa.
For a long time, American policymakers have viewed Africa essentially as a problem to be solved, while Beijing perceived the continent as an area that abounds with opportunity. So the Chinese, for the last at least 2 decades, have been much more strategic in their engagement with the continent, and you get the sense that America is essentially playing catch-up.
If the U.S. wants to catch up with China, says Mutiga, it should focus on new realities in Africa, where economies and populations are growing and people are becoming more educated. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
A second round of UN broker talks aimed at achieving a ceasefire between the rival governments in Libya has resumed, with the chief UN mediator expressing hope of making progress. Lisa Schlein reports from the site of the talks in Geneva.
The first round ended with no breakthrough earlier this month, but UN Special Envoy Hassan Salami says much has occurred during the past week and a half, which makes him more hopeful of finding an acceptable solution. He says separate talks dealing with Libya's financial and economic situation are moving ahead, and political talks are set to begin in Geneva next week. He notes the UN Security Council has adopted a resolution supporting calls by world leaders last month during a summit in Berlin for a permanent ceasefire in Libya. The UN mediator acknowledges that the situation on the ground in Libya remains fragile, and the temporary truce agreed to by the warring parties is often violated.
Where new attacks took place even today in the very port of Tripoli, where incidents take place left and right, while this situation remains on the ground, nobody has so far reneged on the principle of accepting the truce.
Five military officers representing Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj's internationally recognized government and five officers appointed by rebel military commander Khalifa Haftar are meeting to negotiate an end to nearly 1 year of bloody conflict in and around Tripoli. That conflict, triggered by Haftar's military assault on the Libyan capital in April, has cost thousands of lives and displaced hundreds of thousands of people. Salame says finding a solution will be a challenge. Nevertheless, he says there are reasons to be hopeful.
First, because the Libyans do want an end to this tragedy they have painted themselves into, but also that the Berlin Conference has produced a follow-up machinery that will push for the implementation of this resolution that basically translates into legal terms the conclusions of the Berlin Conference.
The two delegations are meeting in separate rooms and the UN mediator is shuttling between them. Salami says both sides have decided it was better not to hold face-to-face talks just yet. Salami says that does not concern him because he is interested in getting an agreement, not a photo op. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Uganda has released additional 13 Rwandan citizens who had been detained at various locations in Uganda as a further step to normalize relations between the two nations. Ugandan Foreign Affairs Minister Sam Kutesa says the move is a further implementation of the agreement the two countries signed last August in Angola's capital, Luanda. He hopes Rwanda would reciprocate the gesture and open its border with Uganda, which closure has hurt commerce and the free movement of people. Mugumi Davis-Rakarinji reports from Kampala.
While releasing Rwandan nationals this Tuesday, Uganda's Foreign Affairs Minister, Sam Kutesa, said Uganda is willing to implement the Luanda MOU that was signed by the two heads of states.
As a further gesture of goodwill, the government of Uganda has decided to release 13 more Rwandan nationals in addition to the 9 that were released on the 8th of January 2020. It must be understood that the withdrawal of the charges against these people does not in any way suggest that the accused are innocent of the charges for which they were being tried. It is simply an option that the government of Uganda has chosen in order to facilitate normalization of relations in the context of the Rwanda process.
Uganda President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni and his Rwandan counterpart, President Paul Kagame, last year signed an agreement in the Angolan capital, Rwanda, to expedite a process aimed at restoring relations between the two countries. Both countries accuse each other of interfering with each other's security. The released are accused of serious crimes such as espionage, while others are accused of human trafficking. Frank Mugambage, Rwanda's ambassador to Uganda, received his fellow countrymen and said that his country is equally playing its part to ensure the two countries' relations are restored.
The government of Rwanda is fully committed to implement the Rwanda Memorandum of Understanding, and the government of Rwanda, I'm not aware of any propaganda or comments negative to Uganda which have been said of recent. But we have continued to see media propaganda by Uganda media outlets.
The sour relations between the two nations resulted into the partial closure of the borders. Well, as Ugandans allowed to travel to Rwanda, Rwanda issued a travel advisory for its citizens from traveling to Uganda. The closure has also affected trade and commerce between the two countries. Minister Kutesa acknowledges citizens of each nation have been largely affected by the impasse.
These are very close communities that have relatives across the borders, They cannot visit each other because of the closure of the border. People who have been going to school in different places, including coming to Uganda, are not coming. And I think it is not good for integration.
Rwanda and Uganda are members of the East African Community, or EAC, an intergovernmental organization composed of 6 countries in the East African region that also have Burundi, Kenya, South Sudan and Tanzania. One of the protocols of the EAC is free movement of citizens across member countries. President Museveni and President Kagame are scheduled to meet this Friday at the common border to discuss further how to improve the country's relations. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarind in Kampala, Uganda.
Today's Wednesday, February 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Kenya's civil society and survivors of the Nyayo House torture chambers are demanding compensation years after their detention. Nyayo House is a skyscraper in Nairobi that hosts several government departments. The building is particularly known for its detention facilities in its basement, where many opponents of the late President Daniel Arap Moi's government were beaten by special branch officials. Speaking Tuesday at the Nyayo building, survivors and victims asked the government to convert the chambers into shrines. As Marine Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga was among the Nyayo House torture chambers detainees.
Nyayo House in Nairobi is known for its detention facilities in the basement, often called Nyayo House torture chambers. Yesterday, Tuesday, survivor marking 16 years after opening of the chambers to the public asked the government to honor the report by Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission, TJRC, that investigated Nyayo House torture cases and several victims that included student leaders from the universities. Victim Christopher Odur narrates his horrible encounter in the chambers that left him impotent.
The most humiliating part of it was that after I'd been beaten and I'd put in water, when I was removed in the morning and told to sit down, naked as I was born, a very beautiful lady came with a panga in her hand, asked me whether I'd been circumcised. Sit properly, I want to circumcise you today with this. Say, use that in chopping off my head. So she just came with high heels, stepped on my manhood. You get annoyed, there is nothing you can do.
Mr. Christopher shared the chambers with the former Prime Minister Raila Odinga before being jailed for 6 years for allegedly undermining the government during the Moi era. He says he could go days without food in the chambers that left many with scars.
And when you are blindfolded and taken there, for the 4 days and nights that you are going to sleep there, no breakfast, no lunch, no supper. At the end of it, you leave when you cannot even see. So it was humiliating. Up to the 78th day, when I was removed, taken to traffic headquarters, I stayed there for a whole day for the cautionary statement, where they tell you the statement you give can be used in a court of law against you.
The late President Daniel Moi's regime was deemed as dictatorial and autocratic before 1992, when Kenya was still a single-party state at that time. Human rights organizations such as Amnesty International, as well as special investigation by the United Nations, accused Moi of human rights abuses during his presidency. Wallace Moura, whose father Kang'ethe Mungai survived the torture at Nyayo House, has asked the government to implement the report by Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission.
We are calling the Minister for Internal Security, Dr. Fred Matiang'i, to urgently do the following. One is to issue a repeal order for legal notice number 11 of 1991 to allow our unrestricted and permanent access to the former torture chambers so that we can work with people of goodwill to realize the dream of converting them into a shrine of remembrance for posterity, as recommended by the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission, whose report and recommendation have now been gazetted by government.
Kenyans who went against the government in the 80s and early 90s suffered the consequences, as some died during detention or soon after being released due to injuries caused during the torture. The civil societies are still fighting to have the torture victims' names gazetted and compensated by the government. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Witnesses in northwest Cameroon say around 24 people were killed last Friday when government forces invaded a village suspected of being used by separatist forces as a hideout. The government says 7 of those killed were rebels, but NGOs maintain that the killings are similar to a 2016 incident in which 2 women and 2 children were shot dead by the army in a war against Boko Haram militants. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé. Hundreds of Christians inside a Roman Catholic church in Yaoundé sing that Cameroon needs peace and God's intervention, especially after what clergyman Timothy Siwe says was a massacre in the English-speaking village of Ngarbo.
People are massacred and burned in their houses. It's not acceptable. It's not acceptable in our 21st century. Women, babies, houses burnt. This is too much. We have to come as one people and stop this genocide that is going on.
Fleeing villagers said they saw armed men dressed in Cameroon military outfits in the Ngarbo attack that killed at least 22 people last Friday. Defense Minister Joseph Betty Asomo said soldiers on a reconnaissance operation were attacked by separatist fighters who had transformed parts of Ngarbo into their logistics base. Asomo said 7 rebels were killed and a woman and 4 children were killed by a fire in a separatist hideout that also served as a fuel depot. Government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi says information that it was a massacre was propaganda from separatists to discredit government troops.
Nos forces républicaines, dont la vocation placée sous le signe de l'honneur et de la fidélité.
Sadi says Cameroon is not only surprised but scandalized that its military, which has remained professional and republican in defending the nation and its people against terrorists, can be accused of violence against the same people it protects. He says such accusations are intended to destabilize the forces. Kawala, coordinator of Stand Up for Cameroon, a group promoting justice and peace in the country, says the incident is similar to one a few years ago in which 2 women and 2 children, one of them a baby, were shot dead by the army in Cameroon's war against Boko Haram. The military denied it was responsible, but later bowed to international and domestic pressure and arrested the culprits.
It is one in a series that includes the cold-blooded murder of 2 women and their children in Zelevet in 2015, the assassination of over a dozen people in Ashigashia in the extreme north in 2016, the burning and looting of over 50 houses in Bali in January 2020, and attacks and killings reported in Bui, Gokitunja, and Mezam divisions over the last 10 days. At Stand Up for Cameroon, we will stand up to say no, not in our name, not in our time.
The United Nations Humanitarian Assistance Office in Cameroon has called for immediate investigations. Armed groups have been fighting since 2017 to create an independent state in the English-speaking North, West, and South West regions, separate from the rest of Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé. Gambian President Adama Barrow has called for an end to tribal politics, which he says could destabilize the nation. Mr. Barrow spoke Tuesday during ceremonies marking Gambia's 55th independence anniversary. Pandero Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The Gambia is a former British colony. It attains independence in February of 1965 under the leadership of the late Gambian President Sir Dauda Kairaba Jawara. As the country celebrates nationhood, the Gambia is still battling with abject poverty, healthcare, and economic challenges. Access to reliable electricity, clean drinking water, affordable internet, and job opportunities for the youth continue to pose as a threat to national development. But President Adama Barrow remains optimistic. He says the Gambia's future is bright. He knows that with national unity, honesty, and justice, the sky is the limit for the Gambia. Barrow therefore calls on citizens to bury their political differences and stay away from tribal politics.
While ethnicity contributes significantly to our richly blended culture and stands out as a diverse source of strength, if weaponized for selfish reasons, ethnicity has devastating consequences. It has plunged many nations into protracted unrest, destruction, and great instability.
Barrow came to power in December of 2016 after defeating former President Yahya Jammeh in a disputed election. Barrow knows that tribes shouldn't be used as a barometer to define one's citizenship. He says national politics should be guided with honesty and not otherwise.
Party politics, which is often at the root of most deadly ethnic clashes, must not be based on ethnicity. Instead, politics should be driven by a sound vision, appropriate programs, and dedicated service in the best interest of one's nation. The electorate should affiliate with the party that represents the national interest and ensure that we continue to live in peace and harmony in a cohesive democratic society where our collective development aspirations can be fulfilled.
Barrow's statement came in the wake of political unrest in the country. The group calling itself 3 Years Jotna had demanded for Barrow's resignation, which resulted to the arrest of the group's leaders. Barrow has been accused of not honoring his campaign promise. He had earlier promised to stay in power for 3 years, but he has since walked away from that promise. Barrow says elections would be held in 2021, but warns that in the absence of peace, there cannot be any development.
Our national anthem has some of the message perfectly for us. It brings our attention to doing the right thing and emphasis, I quote, "Let justice guide our actions towards the common good and join our diverse people to prove man's brotherhood." Ethnic rivalry is dreadful. Accordingly, I urge all of us to renew our commitment and pledge our firm allegiance to the nation, because the Gambia belongs to all of us.
Barrow also said the Gambia should strive for economic independence.
We must all strive to fend ourselves, feed ourselves, and muster the courage to entrain independence and cooperation in our subcultures, whether at home, in the community, or in our institutions.
The Gambian leader has reaffirmed his government's commitment to pursuing its national development plan agenda. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pan Derim by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and the African Union Chairman on Tuesday in Addis Ababa at the end of a whirlwind Africa tour that included Senegal and Angola. Pompeo's first Africa visit to Africa aims to strengthen commercial ties and revamp America's presence on the continent in countering China's growing dominance. But political analysts say restoring U.S. influence in Africa will be a challenge. Uganda has released additional 13 Rwandan citizens who had been detained at various locations in Uganda as a further step to normalize relations between the two nations. Ugandan Foreign Affairs Minister Sam Kutesa says the move is a further implementation of the agreement that the two countries signed last August in Angola's capital, Luanda. He hopes Rwanda would reciprocate the gesture and open its border with Uganda, which closure has hurt commerce and the free movement of people. And witnesses in northwest Cameroon say around 2 dozen people were killed last Friday when government forces invaded a village suspected of being used by separatist forces as a hideout. The government says 7 of those killed were rebels, but NGOs maintain that the killings are similar to a 2016 incident in which 2 women and 2 children were shot dead. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barty in Washington.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free, pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.